Hey there, nerds. Welcome to ExoLore, the show about facts-based fictional worldbuilding. I'm your host, Moya McTeer, and today I'm joined by an English PhD student, a neuroscientist, and a former physical anthropologist. Her words, not mine. And today, we're imagining the life and culture on an alien planet that has a very eccentric orbit. So, let's get started. Let's start with introductions so that everyone knows who you are and what you're doing here. Misha, you're at the top of my screen, so do you want to start by telling us who you are and what you do and something that you're reading or watching right now?
Sure. My name is Misha Griffewander, and I am an English grad student at Ohio State University. I focus on media from webcomics to video games and speculative fiction, so sci-fi and fantasy, with a special focus on sort of gender, race, and environmental issues. And what I'm reading right now is actually a really cool academic book that I'm writing a review on called The Paradox of Blackness, African-American Vampire Fiction, I believe, which is using stories about African-American vampires as a lens to explore what it means to be Black in America. So
that's amazing. I don't think I've ever even read or seen something with Black vampires.
Yeah, that's one of the things they investigate. They're like, if you think vampires, you think it's a white thing, right?
And
they really go into it's really cool, and I can talk about it for hours. We can do that off recording.
Word. Yeah. Please, I would absolutely love that. Shannon, do you want to go next?
Sure.
Who are you? What do you do? And what are you reading or watching?
Yeah, I'm Shannon Odell. I am a neuroscientist. I just finished my PhD in neuroscience in December.
No big deal.
No big deal. And where I studied memory. Right now, I am watching a lot of Terrace House, the last season. The latest season, that is. I'm almost done with the episodes that are out on Netflix. And then I guess there's some, like, episodes they have in, like, the backlog, but then it gets shut down. So anyway, I've been loving it.
Right.
I love Terrace House also.
Awesome. Kyle, what about you?
I'm Kyle Marion. I am a science communicator, a comedian like Shannon. Shout out.
I'm a comedian too, I forgot.
That's right. Plug, right? I used to study physical anthropology, human evolution, and I taught human gross anatomy for a while out at Stony Brook University. And yeah, I know a little bit about a lot of stuff that I don't know is relevant anymore. So.
Oh, and I realized we didn't do pronouns. Mine are they, them.
She, her.
And I'm also she, her.
So my name's Moya McTeer. I'm an astrophysicist and a folklorist. So that's what I'm bringing to this. My pronouns are she, her, and hers. And I am reading The Poppy War by R.F. Kuang. And it's giving me very, like, The Name of the Wind vibes, which is one of my favorite books by Patrick Rothfuss. So I recommend it. It's pretty good. It's like The Name of the Wind, but better. and by a woman. And it's, like, set in kind of East Asian cultures with myths, and it's really cool. The world building's pretty good, which is relevant to our discussion.
Oh, did I share what I'm, like, watching reading?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think I did. So the last thing that I watched was Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which was very beautiful. But I feel like my actual reading time is spent playing Catan. Relevant?
Relatable.
Yeah?
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
I've been doing a lot of that too, so I get it.
Pretty good. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Animal Crossing.
Yeah, okay, I also could have included, like, what are you playing? What other worlds are you inhabiting in your brain? All right, so let's get started on the planet. So you may have seen in the subject line of the email that I called it eccentric world, which I realize might not be very clear. So the planet that we're building today is a planet that has an eccentric orbit, which essentially just means that instead of an orbit that's a circle, the orbit is an oval, if I can make that shape with my hands. So it's an oval. And one side of the oval is much closer to the planet's star than the other side. So over the course of its year, the planet spends most of its time very far away from its star, and it spends a little bit of time very close to its star. So summer on this planet is like a few weeks long. And over the course of its year, it experiences extreme temperature and brightness swings. So when the planet is closest to its star, the star looks two times brighter. It looks twice as bright as our sun does. And the temperature is about 20% higher than we get here on Earth. And when the planet is the farthest away from its star that it gets, the star looks very dim. It's about a tenth as bright as our sun looks. And the temperature is like half the temperature that we get here on Earth. So that's what we're working with. Let's get started with questions. So the first thing that I usually start with is thinking about the biology and what these what the aliens on this planet would look like. So what types of physical traits do you think the aliens on this planet might evolve?
So funny. I think, well, for me, one of the things is like, okay, so if on this planet some sort of humanoid like actually evolved on it, it's interesting because the relationship that we have with the sun, there are hypotheses out there about why humans ended up bipedal and why we chose to do that in our evolutionary history of our ancestors, one of which is we our ancestors evolved in Africa, and particularly in like savanna areas that had some trees and not. And so like prior to getting on 2 feet, there's a hypothesis that we were arboreal, so tree living in trees, swinging in trees, more like chimpanzees, bonobos. And so like there was a point where we moved on from that kind of tree environment, and that kind of like helped us, pushed us to evolve to walk on 2 feet. And so I wonder what that would mean in terms of like not having too much sun. In which case we didn't, you know, like, you know, you didn't need to have a pressure to be on 2 feet and be less exposed with the heat, or not have as much hair, for example, for your thermoregulation. So maybe these are just like hairy, like surface dwellers, or maybe they're naked underground people. I don't know.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking a lot about the temperature swings and like what that means, and like would that mean, because you know, like most species kind of like homeostasis, you know, they like things to stay the same. They don't want to. So I'm wondering if it's like, do the species like all live underwater, like deep underwater all the time, so they don't really have to be affected by the change in temperature? Or like, are they super mobile in terms of like they go up high into the mountains when they're in the hot time, and then, you know, when it's colder, they go back to like where, to the just like not the mountains. Why can't I speak? but like trying to think of how they would want to regulate their temperatures and how that would change their behaviors, not just like whether they have feet or not, or like what they look like, but also like, I'm of course thinking about their behaviors because neuroscientists.
I was just thinking, like, we have animals that hibernate during the coldest part of the winter, and maybe in this world, I wonder if we instead would have animals hibernating during the hottest part of the year, because mm-hmm. most of the year is the coldest part of the year.
Yeah. And to add to that too, like a lot of animals, especially mammals, are like either diurnal, so during the day animals, or nocturnal during the night. And if they evolved eyeballs like many of us, they would have giant pupils because they're probably more accustomed to darkness, that sort of thing. So, like, super cute anime, like, giant pupils.
Yeah.
Is my bet.
Which would be really hard to, like, then if it was twice as bright as our sun, I feel like it would be really hard on your eyes that had evolved for mostly, like, a tenth of our sun's brightness.
For, like, 2 weeks, they're just, like, walking around with their eyes closed.
or maybe.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's hibernation, right?
Yeah.
Or thinking about hibernation and life cycles, maybe it's just that they're only, the life cycle only lasts the warm season. And, you know, maybe it's a species that lays an egg and the egg, you know, kind of just sits there the whole winter and then only hatches. That would be kind of fun. I would love to live in an egg.
I feel like that would make sense that there are these species that do have that, like, really short, like, just for a summer life cycle, but then I feel like the vacuum left the rest of the year would be filled by something, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The night walkers and the day walkers.
Yes.
Right. So there are obviously going to be a lot of different species on this planet. And I'd like us to focus on what type of species and what traits and behaviors we think would lead a species to be the most dominant on the planet, like the human equivalent. It doesn't have to look like humans. In past Exolore episodes, we've decided turtles, moles, various creatures that are based on animals here on Earth rose to power because their traits just made them more successful. So can you think of any animals here on Earth that you feel would do very well in this environment?
I think that you have those, the two potential options, right, are the, like, animal that's, like, well adapted to the cold part of the year and is able to sort of hide or hibernate or move to withstand the warm part of the year, or highly adaptable animals, more like humans, I guess, that are able to survive throughout the year through use of mobility or tools or something like that. And I feel like you could follow them in either path.
Yeah. I haven't done anything with migratory animals yet in an Exolore episode. So maybe they migrate, because just like we have here on Earth, different latitudes experience seasons differently. And so you can have an animal that just moves to a different latitude during the hot seasons. Like, moves to one of the poles.
Yeah, I like that. I like a migratory animal. I'm trying to think of what animals are the most migratory besides, like, it could be fun to do, like, a goose or something, like a bird. Or, like, a butterfly. I don't know.
Yes.
Or whales.
I would love to do, like, giant geese. Giant geese would make me so happy.
I think one of the things that, like, pop into my head too is even if they're migratory, what their skin or exoskeleton might look like, because the more that they can easily thermoregulate, or, like, it might be that during the times when the planet is further away from their star, that, you know, they have softer skin and, like, you know, but then during the times when they're closer to the star, they have, you know, they look like the Tesla new monster truck thing.
Are there any biological mechanisms that can actually make that happen?
In humans, in a lot of animals, melanin is a huge player for allowing our skin to be adaptable, right? So I'm kind of curious what that means for animals that would then have to deal with, like, extreme seasonality. Trying to think. I don't know. Not sure what comes to mind.
Okay. Cool. Misha, what were you going to say?
I was just thinking that, I don't remember who, I think it was maybe Shannon mentioned underwater, living in water is, like, a potential way to help with the homeostasis issue. Because, you know, water, I believe, I'm not the scientist here. Water heat up less fast than land. But
very scientific. 100%.
Yes.
Yep.
So that, like, animals that were able to, like seals, for instance, that are able to pack on the blubber for the cold time of the year. And then maybe these animals would be able to like dive and spend those 2 weeks of the summer like pretty deep where the sunlight can't penetrate as much. And so the heat from that really close star would not be as big a deal for them.
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go with that. Let's go with seal people.
Yes.
Also, it's cute.
Yeah.
So cute. It's so cute. And maybe during the summer weeks, they can find like cute little underground or like underwater caves so they can still breathe. Because they breathe air, right?
Seals, yeah. I think seals are mammals. Yeah.
They're mammals. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was confused if you meant like this new creature on your planet is air breathing, in which case, I don't know, your choice.
Yeah. Oh, do we know what the atmosphere is like?
Yeah, that's the great thing about this.
Do we know, like...
You can assume that everything except for what we decide is different is exactly like Earth. Okay, so we have settled on seal people, so they can like put on blubber when it's colder, and they can migrate pretty easily through the water. I absolutely love this. let's move on to talking a bit past their biology. Let's think about their culture. Kyle, you look like you have something to
say. I'm so glad that you said that, because as soon as we started talking about sort of like what is called phenotype, so like what something looks like, immediately in my head I'm like, oh, sexual selection. You know, like during the winter months versus during the summer months of 2 weeks, like when do they mate, and also what is like the signal of like, hey, I'm hot.
Yeah. You know.
Let's talk about that. Yeah, what would that be? What would a mating ritual on this planet look like?
I was thinking about, like, you were talking about underwater caves, and having, I kind of liked the idea of having that time when in the summer when you, like, go into down into the depths, and it's, like, 2 weeks that are, like, totally different from the rest of the year. And I feel like that could feel sort of like a sacred time of the year, or potentially that's the time when you're like, hey, I found a really cool cave.
Yeah.
You want to come check out this cave I found?
I love that. And that kind of reminds me of my favorite animal behavior that I can think of, which is bowerbirds that create the bowers. Does anyone else know this?
I'm not familiar.
So bowerbirds like create a, like, they're birds and they like use twigs, or they'll use anything they find to create like a beautiful little space in the forest, and that's how they attract mates. It has nothing to do with the mating. It's just they create a beautiful space, and then aww. And then the mates come and they check it out and they're like, oh, I don't like it, or oh, I like it. And I just love that idea of like,
that's perfect.
Decorating.
I love that, because it's like the sexual selection is, can you signal to others that you can make the coziest den
yes,
during the hottest months, yes, or the hottest weeks of the year?
Yes.
I also love this because I imagine that sets up a market or like an industry for consultants who will help people build the best like underwater cave dens that they possibly can to attract mates. Like that is a job that people will have, yeah, on this planet.
Well, and like, I think that translates really well from the pure like sort of biology of like, can you make a safe place to live during the summer, to the cultural, like, well, like, I really liked this person's, you know, cave at first, but they had decorated it, like, really pretentiously, and so I wasn't into that. Like, it translates really well into culture and the sort of, like, higher
absolutely
intellect.
Yeah.
Yeah, there could be whole reality TV shows about this.
Yes!
I wonder what cave paintings would be like. Right, like,
picking a cave before you pick your partner.
Yeah, like, yes. It's like blind dating. It's like, or you, yes, get to just see the profile, but you don't get to see the pictures, and it's like choose, and it's like, okay.
Oh, This is fantastic. Since we're talking about dating and mating anyway, what about beauty standards? What types of traits would be really attractive on this planet?
Blubber.
Yeah.
Blubber. Fur. A lot of fur.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Big tail.
Maybe tusks? Do they have tusks?
Yeah.
Is that walruses?
Seals?
I don't know anything about seals, apparently.
Sea lions, I think, have tusks.
Yeah.
But we can verify because we have internet.
Yeah. Or we can just make it up because we are creating this creature in our minds.
Seals have whiskers, right?
Yeah. So, like, maybe.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. The question of tusks, though, is also, like, tied to dominance, right? And showing, you know, sometimes, like, there's a lot of animals. In primates, the size of your canines, like, really also signal both, like, competition, as well as, like, you know, a diet. But one of the other things too that's interesting is that kind of, like, show of teeth plays a role in, you know, whether or not you're like trying to be submissive or like trying to be dominant in groups, especially for social groups. So, like, are they social? If they're social animals, then there's a lot of those dynamics that, like, flow into dentition in many ways.
Kyle, this is about to get real personal. Is that why I'm very attracted to people who have long canines? Like, this is just something I've noticed about myself.
It's because you like vampires, I assume.
I think it's that.
Okay, cool. Glad I put that out there. Awesome. I'm really interested in how they would kind of preserve and pass on knowledge from generation to generation. So I feel like this plays really well into Misha and Shannon's respective backgrounds in English and memory. So how do you think they would do it? If you could come up with, like, your ideal way for them to pass down knowledge.
I feel like there's a question of preservation just due to the physical, like, situation of being underwater, right? Because, like, paper, not super great. Even, like, stone carvings, I think, well, deeper down, I don't think they would be worn away as much. Again, science, not my thing, but I feel like you have a question of, like, durability, and I wonder if those, like, seasonally linked rituals and storytelling and like behaviors that you're expected to do and modeled by your parents and everyone else in your community would be an important vehicle for transmitting knowledge. Yeah,
I feel like my mind went immediately to that because, like, it's seals. They don't really have hands, I don't think so, for writing and stuff. But I like to even think about the idea of even, like, language and, like, what would language be? Is it actually, like, a vocalized thing, or could, like, language exist in, like, you know, kind of, like, performance, like the way they swim or, like, how the communication happens could be a cool thing to think about. Like, what's the best way to communicate underwater? Maybe there's different forms. Like, there's long-range communication versus, like, if you're actually visually in front of someone. But, yeah, I love the idea of, like, yeah, there's, like, seasonality to it. So, like, what are the rituals? What are the stories? What are the performances they're doing?
That makes me think of dance as a something that, like, is better underwater because you can move in more directions. Mm. Especially if you don't have hands, like, that's fine. You can do cool tail dances. And that might also be something that ties into the sort of mating and sexual differentiation, where, like, if you are really eloquent as you dance, like, that's the equivalent of being really well spoken and really charming, and also potentially, like, you feel confident enough in your ability to care for yourself and your family, that you don't mind burning a couple extra calories, doing a cool dance.
Yes.
One of the things that jump out at me too is like, this is, I feel like our chosen dominant species is very social, like, because a lot of these things, you know, it's a lot harder even in the ocean to communicate and build kind of culture without that level of social connection. And so I don't know, maybe some of their language could include bubbles and dance and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, especially if they breathe oxygen, they could make bubbles.
And there are so many different types of bubbles. I don't know if you've seen those really cool videos of like the, like there are the donut bubbles. Like they can, like they can make bubbles of different shapes underwater, and I feel like that will add some complexity to the language that would be really great.
I also wonder if there's, we're talking about like having a really social species, which I think makes total sense. But if you have like seals, I think you have like a little pod that, and they travel together. And would this species have like, you know, extended clan groups or extended pods that develop their own style of communication? And if they meet, if they happen to meet like a whole nother pod in the ocean, are they going to necessarily have the same, like maybe only one of the pods relies on dance and one of them is like, we think bubbles are better. One of them is like, we just poke each other with our noses. Like,
maybe there's a whole like, a career which is just like being a translator for the different pods, is that you're just, you're, yeah, just kind of you go from place to place and you're like, I know all these languages.
I think that'd be an especially important job because as they migrate, they're gonna run into so many different pods that even if you don't speak the other language, it's important to have some way to communicate with strangers. So yeah, a translator is another coveted position among these people.
That also makes me think that they might have a very, like, a gifting culture, because I feel like a lot of human societies that often run into language barriers have, like, robust tradition of hosting and gifting, because that crosses language barriers much easier.
I love that.
What would some gifts be?
Fish.
Yeah.
But also decorations, I think, if it sounds like it's, aesthetics is really important to this culture. Things that you can put in your home, things that you can use to decorate your area and attract whoever you're trying to attract would be really valuable.
Yeah.
So things like stones and coral and colorful underwater plants type of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see there also being another career of like, I'm thinking only jobs, like individuals who go out, like, not near where the pods are, and just search for things, like, at the water's edge to collect and bring back, like, weird plants, yeah, or, like, mm-hmm, just, like, weird rocks and stuff.
Yeah. Well, and there's, yeah, stuff like Petoskey stones and stuff that I think only... they're a lot easier to find on the beach rather than like all the way underwater.
Yeah.
What are those?
Oh, Petoskey. This shows I'm from Michigan, where they're like, it's a big thing. And they're named after a place in Petoskey. It's this specific kind of rock that shows, they look pretty normal when they're not wet, but when you get them wet, they have a sort of tiled look to them that's from little fossils. It's just like a little colony of sea creatures that are all over in Michigan. But they're really pretty, and people, aww, like polish them and use them as jewelry and stuff.
That's so nice.
Yeah. Michigan trivia.
this could fall into the realm of gifts, but I have a two-parter question. The first part of this question is for Shannon, and it has to do with drugs. So I'm really curious about what makes some substances react with our brains to get them high. Is it because they're rare in our environment, so our brains just aren't used to them?
Yeah, I mean, it depends, like, what we're looking about in terms of drugs. If we're looking at the high aspect, then it has to do with, like, normally the feeling of, like, high or, like, is, like, associated with serotonin. It's an actual, like, you know, it activates serotonin receptors. In terms of, like, the addictive nature of why we like drugs or we seek out drugs, has to do with dopamine, so another neurotransmitter. So it's not actually that they're, like, rare. It's actually that they act on, you know, things that they act on receptors we already have in our brain. So that's why they actually work the way they do. They kind of just take advantage of, I mean, I don't know if drugs take advantage of these receptors that we already have in our brain, or they've co-evolved with us sometimes to kind of be that way. So, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to think about. Are we thinking about what drugs would be?
Yeah, and drugs can be recreational. They can be spiritual. They can be used for so many different things. They can be given as gifts. And so I was wondering if we could think of what types of mind-altering substances they might have in this society.
Yeah, I mean,
I guess that's just something we, like, have to make up unless we know the chemistry of everything under the ocean.
Right, true. I mean, we could also think about things like if they do have, you know, brains similar to ours, there is a inherent, like, if we were talking about novelty, like, most species are drawn to novel things. You know, novelty actually elicits, you know, a rewarding response. So maybe super novel things in these species brains, maybe they do act like a drug where they become really addicted because you want that novelty.
And that would maybe stimulate a migration response as well.
Oh yeah, that's true. Of like, you want to go to a new place, and yeah, cause they have to be driven. Yeah. In some way.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I can imagine that there are some things, like plants, that only grow during the 3 weeks of summer. And so there's a huge push to gather as much of that during that short period as you can and kind of stock up for the rest of the year.
And you can even think about, like, you know, things that are grown in warmth, or they might be high in sugar and things like that, and that's always going to be something that's rewarding as well, because it's just like a high energy content. And yeah, most species brains are wired to, like, really like things that are high in energy.
That makes me think that, like, because the summer weeks will be more extreme in temperature, right, you're more likely to get fruits and flowers that are, like, so sweet during that time, and so they'll probably be, like, the rush to land specifically for that sort of thing. Or, like, there's a very particular seasonality where these guys will, you know, get high.
Yeah.
Or get drunk, right? Like, sugars get you drunk, right? Fermentation. So, yeah.
So maybe there's that push-pull of, like, it's sort of dangerous for them to go up to the surface because of that extreme heat. But you have, like, if you're one of the daring ones and if you're willing to, like, put your body through that, there's all these cool flowers, fruits, like algae blooms, I don't know,
yeah,
that await you on the surface and will be really valuable if you can make the journey back.
That's another job right there.
Yeah.
I like that we keep coming back to different roles that this society would have. That makes me happy.
I like saying that they're roles and not jobs. Because they're not constrained by capitalism or anything. Yeah, like that.
No capitalism.
Yeah, they just have.
No, we're not trying to dictate their economy.
No job.
Yeah. We haven't explicitly talked about how they would perceive and measure time, because we measure time by, like, the sun always looks the same and it has a very predictable way of moving across the sky. Especially if they're underwater, they, like, and with the weird orbit that this planet has, that's just probably not the same. So how do we think they would measure time or perceive it? Would they even care? Are they a very chill people?
Hmm.
Well, I feel like you'd at least have the season in terms of, like, you'd at least have the year marker, because if they're migrating and if there's that, like, intense hot time, they would probably notice that. As for, like, day-night cycles, though, that's really dubious whether I think they would keep track of that. It would depend on what their sleep cycle is a little bit, right?
I guess my question for Moya, too, is, like, what would the tides be on this planet, especially since, like, the sun is a little further? Are there, you know, the stars are a little further, like, are there moons? What are the other things that might affect their environment, especially if they're water-based primarily?
That's a really great question. I hadn't even thought about tides, but now that you bring it up, so the planet has a moon. It's the same moon as ours. It goes around at the same speed, which means when the planet is far away from the star, the moon is doing, it has like a, it's dominating the gravity slightly more, so that the tide is slightly bigger. And then when the planet is very close to its star, tides probably wouldn't be as extreme because the star is just dominating gravity so much. So that would even make it easier for them in some ways to go up onto the shore and collect these fruits and flowers that grow in the summertime.
Yeah, I like the idea that they're, like, very in tune with the tides. Like, they like, regulate time by, like, paying attention to the tides. They're seeing where it is. You know, I wonder if there's even some, like, kind of structures in, like, different pods. Like, they've, like, kind of a calendar system of, like, when the tide gets to there, when the tide gets to there. They know kind of where they are in the year.
That also makes me think that if the tides are extreme when they're away from the star, then that might mean, like, if they're, like, real estate wise, there'll be plenty of caves because of, like, water erosion, right? Near the shore. And so what would that mean in terms of, like, prime real estate for, you know, housing down or, like, homing it up, you know?
Yeah. And how do they, if this isn't a capitalist world, how do they decide who gets the nice caves?
If a nice, like, is a nice cave one that is underwater, like, is, like, deep underwater all the time, or is it one that, like, has a lot of variety? Because I think it would, like, who gets it, but it might also depend on what constitutes nice, because if we're, maybe if the nicest caves are ones that are, like, safely underwater all the time, people who are older or needier or, like, need to be protected somehow might get those. But maybe if the sort of riskier caves are more desirable, that probably would lead to more, I think, competition or, like, more, just competition between people for it.
I like that you brought in age. It made me think of people, like, how the joke, the stereotype is that old people move to Florida when they retire here in the U.S. Like, the very safe caves that are always, like, very stable and always underwater, the older seals will move there, and the younger seals, just like young people, like, want to live in cities where there's lots to do and things are changing all the time. The young seals are living in these, like, more unpredictable and less stable caves. So it's not necessarily a matter of nice versus less nice, but people have preferences, and there's enough of different types of caves for everyone to get what they want at the time. But Kyle, what were you going to say?
It also, along the lines of what you're saying, Moya, I feel like that would also have implications for, like, the types of, you know, attraction. Are you attracted to the bad type, the homey type, you know? Like,
yeah. How dangerous of a cave do you like?
Right.
That also brings up the question, though. I think we are imagining that you have, like, you choose a cave location, you choose, like, you decorate it, and that's a home space for you. How does that fit in with them being migratory? do they always come back at some point in the year to their same caves? Or is this something like you set up your cave for 2 weeks, you show it off, and then you leave and you don't maybe ever see that cave again?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Or are there like two sets of caves? Are the winter cave and the summer cave?
There's a lot of societies that have basically like winter and summer habitations that they go back and forth between, especially for grazing. And we haven't brought up the possibility of any kind of like domesticated animals for the seals, but ooh, I think that's well established.
Yeah, what would their farming or like livestock look like? Do they herd fish?
Oh, sorry. I feel like you could. I mean, you can't really put them in like a pasture because they'll just like you can't build a fence. But there are species, like symbiotic species, where, for instance, I can remember like there's that particular kind of coral, I think it is, that clownfish like to hang in. And so maybe if you were able to cultivate like a coral in a specific place, and so that you knew it would draw the symbiotic fish, if you were careful, you could harvest some of those fish while leaving the sort of symbiotic system in place.
Yeah,
that's tricky, and I love it.
Yeah, I like that. It's the idea of like, yeah, or like rather than having like, you know, like sheep or anything like that, it's more like farming. It's like kind of. I immediately thought of that they would have like logs that have like algae and fungi and stuff living on them that they like collect and they place in like a little farm. But like that's a similar thing. It's kind of like collecting things that naturally occur and just kind of collecting it into a space and kind of nurturing it so that they can then feed off of it.
Yeah, it feels a little bit more like forestry almost rather than agriculture. Yeah.
What about fashion? Like, I know that seals don't wear clothes here on Earth. And if you're underwater, you probably don't wear clothes like we wear.
They all have hats, top hats, all of them. That's the one thing they have, top hats.
They must have a top hat. Totally.
And everywhere they swim, they're just like, stay on.
Yeah, it makes no sense, but it's kind of a thing.
Culture.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that you could do something really cool with tattooing. There are inks and needles aplenty underwater, even if not the kinds that we usually use for tattooing.
Well, there's a lot of animals in the ocean who, you know, get scars and scarring in many ways, and it becomes part of their story and their signal to their social group. So that could be part of it.
I really like that. I also really like the idea of elaborately decorated tails. I think of tails as something that are purely functional, but what if they found a way to turn them into something like art? And that's how you really like show your individuality and your personality.
Maybe at one time there was a seal that like fell into a bunch of kelp and then came back home and it was just the fashion, you know.
Yeah.
Like a feather boa made of kelp.
Yes.
Right. Like at first it was like, oh my gosh, I gotta get out. Oh, help. And then everyone's like, you look good.
Yeah.
That's a thing.
I like that.
Yeah. I also love the idea too of tying in like decorating your tail with like life cycle marking, like maybe when you feel like either when your community or you determine like I'm an adult now, you fill up like a certain portion of your tail with scarring or tattoos or jewelry, and then like at another important moment in your life you do like another section, and so you can like glimpse at someone's tail and sort of see where they are in life and how they feel about that by the amount of decoration and the type they've chosen.
Yeah, I like that, especially in terms of like when we were talking about communication and language, since it's a little more like elaborate, there might just be a lot of visual cues that they'll be able to tell like a lot about a person just by like how you decorate your tail.
We also, because we also talked about the sort of the desire and the danger of going into, you know, the mountains or whatever during the hot summer months, what that means in terms of them going back into their habitat, and like what plants they drag with them on their bodies, you know, and that becomes part of like their story or their fashion. It's like, oh, you know, Joe over there went into the brushes and so he's covered in needles. How cool. Versus like somebody else who's just covered in like, I don't know, like moss. And you're like, oh, yeah. You just stuck around the shores. I see. Okay.
Yeah. It's this planet's version of that magazine question. Like, what do you always carry in your purse? What do you always have with you?
Yes.
If someone's like, willow branches, cool. They're like, yeah, okay, we all have that.
Yeah.
Right. So we're getting to the end of the hour. So do any of you have any last thoughts about this planet? Something that you wish we had said but didn't?
Did we name the species, or does that happen at the end?
What do you want to name them?
I don't know. I just like the idea of naming them. If anyone has any ideas, I'm bringing nothing to the table. I just would like a name.
You brought the question to the table, and that's more than half the battle.
I'm so bad at names. I'm like, the Moyans.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, thanks. That's like scientists who name units after themselves. It's like the most like narcissistic thing you can possibly do. You know, if the viewers or the listeners want to come up with a name for this planet or this species, yes. I'm sure we would all absolutely love to hear it or see it. Any other last thoughts about the world?
One thing that like a lot of biologists and evolutionary like scientists always end up thinking about is like size of genitals. And I hate it, but it's like, there is always a million papers about the size of the genitals because of their social structure or how they evolved. Like, I cannot tell you how many papers I've seen specifically about, oh, poor gorillas, one of the biggest, if not the biggest primate, and has the has the smallest body ratio to their genitals, or like to the penis. And you're just like, why is that a paper? But also fair. Yeah. I guess it's a biological question, sure.
I guess you should have started there, huh?
Probably, could've. Yeah.
I will definitely start the next ExoLore episode with, so how big are their genitals? Great. Well, Kyle, how big do you think their genitals are?
I think it would just depend on, like, how big their teeth are. Right, because I mean, if the signal
image of, like, seals with just massive teeth, yeah. Like their cute little seal faces, and they open their mouths and they're like, rah!
I like the idea of their genitals being in their teeth. You know,
right? Evolution is weird. Right. You
do
you know?
Mean in their you mouth or like actually in the teeth? Like their teeth open and it comes out.
Yeah, they bite people to reproduce. We're back to vampires. Oh boy.
There we go. Full circle.
Okay, I feel like we were all joking, but this is officially canon for this planet.
Yeah.
This is real. Great. So now we are actually very close to the end of the hour. If people want to learn more about you and keep up with what you're doing, how can they do that? And let's go backwards from before. So Kyle, how can people find out more about you and what you're doing?
They can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Kyle Marian, KyleMarian.
And what are you doing? You do a lot of cool shit, so.
I mean, there's a pandemic, so I've been on hiatus. So mostly just like, you know, playing Catan. If anyone wants to play Catan Universe with me, let me know. That that is where I am because I don't own a Nintendo Switch. There you go.
Nice. Shannon, what about you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, both at Shodell, S-H-O-D-E-L-L. You can check out the podcast I host called The Science of Self-Care, where me and two comedians look at the science behind the latest self-care fads. You could also follow me on my other podcasts called Fun City, which is an RPG Shadowrun podcast.
I think Misha just found a new podcast to listen to.
Yes.
And Misha, what about you?
You can find me on Twitter at Misha Grifka, which is M-I-S-H-A-G-R-I-F-K-A. I talk about a lot of stuff, including being a PhD in English, and I also write speculative fiction, I draw, and I am on an RPG podcast, D&D 5e podcast called Big Dice Energy, oh. So you can check that out.
I found a new podcast.
I really want to learn how to play D&D.
I can help.
Okay.
Great. I've found so many new podcasts. Thank you for that. And thank you for being on the show. This was so fun. I'm going to be thinking about this world for a while. And to our listeners and viewers, if you are also going to be thinking about this world for a while, please feel free to make some art about it. Share it with the hashtag Exolore and I'll check it out. I absolutely love when people send me art about the worlds that we create here. So please do that. But I think that's the end. We'll end there. Thanks again so much.
And that's our eccentric planet. If you like this episode, then share it with your friends and be sure to subscribe to Exolore wherever you get your podcasts. That way you know that you'll never miss a new episode when it comes out. I'll catch you next time on Another World.